I've taken you first through Van Ralte and the A movement, as it's called. And Abraham Kuyper and the B movement. The A movement takes us back basically to the 1830s, and the B movement a half century later to the 1880s. The A movement, out of which emerged the first settlement of Holland, Michigan, was known as A because A comes before B. But if you want to associate it with something, you can associate it with afscheiding, which means secession. A tendency toward withdrawal and isolation, thinking of their settlement here as the colony, the colony, and they thought of it as having high and insuperable, though invisible, walls around it. And a heavy emphasis on personal piety and conversion and a walk before the Lord, but not much of a world and life view, not much of a cultural perspective, not much of a sense of calling to become involved in the world in the name of the Lord. That was reserved for the B movement under Kuyper, with more of a world and life view, a notion of the kingship of Jesus Christ over all of life, and that is the Christian's obligation in education, in university life, in science and art and journalism, labor and politics, and all across the board to seek to influence society in the name of Christ, who is Lord of all. Now, what does all of that add up to? We are heirs of both. And in many ways, we still have the struggle of A and B going on in our own bosoms, within our own churches, within our own communities. The impact of both is still there. These, going back to the early settlements in Holland from 1847 and on, and these through a second wave of immigration between 1890 and 1914 when World War I broke out, which put an end to immigration for a while. Up until this time, all of our communities were small, struggling little churches with little communities. It was these immigrations which finally put our churches on their feet throughout mid-America. And the differences between the A and the B movement are evident not only in America, but already in Europe. For example, when the A movement, beginning in 1834, decided in 1856 that it was high time to begin a theological seminary, a big debate emerged about where to locate that seminary. One thing they were sure of, this is the Netherlands at that time, in Zuider Zee, and this little corner is where my folks come from. If straight on the border, they would have been in the Netherlands, but the border being what it was, I ended up in Germany. One thing they were sure, that being of that secessionist withdrawal and separatist mentality, they did not want to settle in Amsterdam or in Rotterdam or in any other big worldly city. So they decided, where should it be? Apeldoorn? Zutphen? Finally, they decided on Kampen. Because Kampen had its back against the Zuider Zee, it had a moat all the way around it, and the only way in was with a train from Zwolle. And I think picking a spot like that was not an accident. It reflected something of their outlook on life, a tendency toward isolation and world withdrawal. By the time 1880, rolls around when Kuyper established the Free University, where did he go? He said, it has to be at the crossroads of civilization. It has to be where things are going on. It has to be at the cultural center of the nation, because we as 11 have to be there. We can't just turn over the big economic and academic and political and social decisions to the humanists and the liberals. As Christians, that's where we have to be. Not in Grand Rapids, a little side road town. We ought to be in Chicago. Which was why, by the way, Reverend Peter Eldersfeld's big argument for keeping the back to guard our office.
offices in Chicago. There's always been that tendency to want to pile up everything in Grand Rapids, and they succeeded on most scores. But he insisted that the Back to God Hour had to be at the crossroads of the nation, Chicago.
Well, that same thing happened here. The early Christian schools that were established in the second half of the 19th century were seen as places to shelter children. It was largely the greenhouse model, in opposition to Kuyper, whose idea for Christian school was training for full kingdom service. And it wasn't until the second immigration from 1890 to 1914 that what we call the Christian school movement really got off the ground. I think a couple of years ago, the National Union, now called CSI, celebrated its 75th anniversary. It goes back, if I'm not mistaken, to about 1905. And it's becoming a national movement was largely due to the impact of these people who said, we've got to get out of our little corners, we've got to get into the mainstream, and there be witnesses for the Lord also in education. The same thing is evident in the history of Calvin College. Calvin College was back to 1876. It wasn't until 1920 that Calvin College became a liberal arts college. For the first two, three, four decades of its existence, it was mainly for preachers and teachers. And it wasn't until after this movement, from 1890 to 19, the B movement came, that the vision opened up, that we've got a bigger task than just training teachers and preachers. That medicine, science, and art, and history, and all the rest are also areas into which the Lord calls us to go to serve Him. Also, the tendency of the A movement is to think of the Christian life as revolving almost exclusively around church activities. When they think of kingdom activities and kingdom causes, they think almost exclusively of those that are associated with the church. Whereas Kuyper said, no, politics, labor, which have nothing to do directly with the institutional church, and the press and everything else, all of these too are part of kingdom service. Something like what I was talking about a while ago, APJ, although it's not a church-sponsored organization, is nevertheless a kingdom enterprise. So the differences between the A and the B have come across from Europe with our forefathers and have been with us, I think, throughout our past 100 years of history. Evident also in the fact that it was beginning around 1910 that you begin to see Christian political movements, Christian labor movements, Christian journals almost by the dozens in the 1910s and 20s and 30s, and somehow all of that faded in the 1930s and 40s. Maybe you can reflect with me pretty soon on why that happened. I have some ideas why that happened. And there came a kind of resurgence of interest in these things in the 1950s with new immigrations to Canada. And they began to push these ideas at us again after we had kind of forgotten about them for a generation or so. And the fact that the Canadian 1/4 of the CRC is more strongly influenced by B, whereas historically the American side of the CRC has been more strongly influenced by the A, is evident even in the language question. After our forefathers came here in the middle of the 19th century, they can hung on to the Dutch language for about 75 years. It wasn't until after World War I, when the young men were recruited and sent across to France, and they came back and said, hey, Dad, there really is a world outside the colony. And they speak English out there. I'm overstating the case. But in the 1920s, you begin to get agitation. We need English. Our kids are having trouble with the Dutch. And so in almost every community, Holland, it's Maple Avenue, I think. In Zeeland, it was Third Church. In Kalamazoo, it was Third Church. In Grand Rapids, Bethel, and LaGrave. All of them began for one reason only. They wanted English. There was talk at one time of forming an English-speaking classes. Gather all the churches from Grand Rapids to Chicago who speak English and form one classes so we can speak English in classes instead of Dutch. And the Acts of Senate of the Christian Reformed Church were published in the Dutch language until 1930. And in 1936, there were still three overtures to Senate in the Dutch language, in 1936. Now, our Canadian brothers and sisters, when I was minister there in the 1950s, late 50s, it was 50-50. They never had all Dutch services. From the day they landed, they said one Dutch, one English. Today, you have a hard time finding a Dutch service, just in the large centers. After a quarter of a century, they were really further ahead with the English than we were after 75 years over here. And there's something about the A and the B that's involved in that kind of outlook on life. On this A and B question, maybe you remember in the Banner, April of this year, Stanley Wiersma, also known as Sitzebuning, there was this interview with him. And it's a lengthy interview. I can't read it all. Let me just read two short paragraphs that bear on this subject of the A and the B. I also think, says Wiersma, talking as Sitzebuning, since we have mentioned the 1880s and 1834, the optimum movement is when a person who has been brought up in the 1834 suddenly discovers that there are broader implications to Christianity and becomes an 1880s sort of person. Seitz's home, and my own too, cultivated an 1834 kind of piety, sin and guilt, forgiveness, the need of prayer, the return of Christ, and all that kind of thing. It seems to me that the 1880s kind of people and their children hear a lot about reformation of the world. But after a generation, that starts to sound more and more secular. The way families ought to be run, ought in quotation, is to turn everybody into an 1834 person until he goes to college. Then either Calvin or the Free University or the Institute in Toronto or Schaefer or whoever ought to turn the youngsters into kingdom-oriented people. I'm not sure that it's that easy to switch, but at least in this article, in the kind of place and way, he's struggling with that question, which has been part and parcel of our inheritance all the way through. Now, this is not something that's uniquely ours. This has been part of the Christian struggle in our Western world for 2,000 years. If you want to read a rather heady book on this, there's H. Richard Niebuhr's book called Christ and Culture. Really, it's about how should Christians stand over against the culture, the time in which they live. How is Christianity related to the American scene, let's say? And what does it mean to be in the world and not of it? And he says, I think rather rightly, that there are five basic points of view which have been developed in different Christian communities throughout our Western world over the past 2,000 years. One is the isolationist position. It goes all the way back to an early church father by the name of Tertullian, who says, what does Athens, the center of Greek learning, have to do with Jerusalem, the center of the gospel? His answer was nothing. Separation of the gospel from the world. Isolation. Maybe the best example of that around today are the Amish. Of utter separation, attempted. It's an impossible possibility, but at least a serious attempt at it. A second way was what Niebuhr called accommodation. You seek to accommodate your faith to your surroundings. You regard the American way of life as really the Christian way of life. And you regard the free enterprise system as the biblically ordained way to do business. And so you take your environment, as it were, and you accept it as being Christian without really asking any critical questions about, is it all that biblical? You simply accommodate to the status quo. And in Germany, they accommodated to Hitler and said, that's Christian. And we accommodate to the American way of life and say, no, that's Christian, without asking serious questions. Well, that's the second part. A third is what Niebuhr calls the dualist. And that's been typically the Roman Catholic. Culture is good. Politics and labor and all, that's good. But Christ is better. Being a teacher is good, but being a clergyman is of a higher order. Because most people live on the level of everyday natural affairs in which you use reason. But there are higher callings by which one lives by faith. And so you get a kind of a split level view of life where you live by faith in certain things and you live by common sense in other things. And so you get certain secular things and sacred things. This is mathematics. This is the Bible. The Bible, of course, is the portfolio of the mathematics, right? Now that's that split level. And getting married is good, being a celibate is better in the Roman Catholic tradition. Being a lawyer is okay, but being a minister is far holier than being a lawyer. Just split level. That's the third. The fourth is the dialectical one, which you find in the Lutheran tradition, which also has two kingdoms in it, but they're not like this, they're like this. A Christian always has to live with one foot in the kingdom of God and the other foot in the kingdom of the world, and he's always in a kind of an uneasy tension, always doing a kind of a balance act. You may not withdraw from the world, like the first group said, but you mustn't try to change the world either, because it's under God's judgment. But you ought to also live in the other world, the kingdom of God. And so you end up in a kind of a constant paradox and dialectical tension between the two. In the one, the kingdom of the world, you live by the law. In the other, you live by the gospel. Luther said that he lives by the law of God until he takes his first step up onto the pulpit. Then he moves into the other realm, the realm of the gospel of grace. And that's why in Lutheran churches you have a split chancel. You have the lower one from which the law is read, and you have the higher and bigger one from which the gospel is preached. Well, that's another split view of life. The fifth one he talks about is, you might call it the reformational, which he identifies with Augustine and Calvin. That Christians are here to reform. They are here to witness. They are here to be a salt, to be a light, to be a leaven in the world. That just as God so loved the world that he gave his son to redeem it, and in John 3:16, world is cosmos, C-O-S-M-O-S. God so loved the cosmos, that is the whole creation which fell into sin. God loved it so much he gave his son for the cosmos, not just to save some souls out of the world, not just to save a few elect people out of the world, but he loved that whole world. So that redemption is the restoration of a fallen creation. And if Christ came and in principle has redeemed the world, then Christians ought to be living in it as redeemed people. Well, that's the fifth position. And he said, all Christians fit somehow or other into one of those five, not neatly, because none of us is cleanly one or the other. We got all kinds of mixed up things going on inside of us. It's terribly hard to be consistent. Even the holiest has but a small beginning, let's say, of consistency. But I think there's one other position which Niebuhr maybe didn't sense at the time he wrote it a quarter century or so ago. And I think that that's where most evangelical Christians are today. And I think that's where most of us are today. And I call that the infiltrationist position. That's to say, we accept the existing structures of society. We accept the American way of doing business. We accept the American way of doing politics. But we say we've got to be in it. We may not run away from it, but we don't try to change it either. We say, let's go in and individually try to do the best we can to witness for our Lord. You in your small corner and I in mine. It's really kind of a band-aid approach. We can cut down on the swearing a little bit. We can cut down on the cocktail parties a little bit. But we don't seriously say, hey, can we change the two-party system? Can we find a more just economic order? The way universities are run in this country, is that just? The way the public press and the television go, is that just? Does it recognize the confessional pluralism that's present in our country? That there are Jewish community, there are Catholic and Lutheran and Amish and Calvinist community? It acts as if we're all the same. And it bombards us all with one message, and that's the message of secularism. That's the only message that comes through, on the assumption that your religion and politics don't mix, and religion and business don't mix, religion and public education don't mix. So religion becomes more and more a personal and private affair, and we as Christians allow the secularists to draw the line between what's religious and what's secular. And you know where he draws it. He keeps pushing it over and over. He claims more and more of life as secular. And so we're left holding less and less of the bag, and pretty soon they push us right off the board. You know? Well, I think most evangelical Christians in North America today tend to be, in that sense, infiltrationists. But let me come back in about 5 minutes or 10 at the most. I want to leave at least 15 for a change, for a little discussion and reaction. Come back to our own community, the American, mid-American Calvinist community over the past 100 years. I know of at least 3 studies that have been done on this community, out of which we come, most of us, which helps us to understand how we got to be the way we are, and who are we, and where do we go from here. The first study is a dissertation written by Henry Swanska, Calvin Seminary, which he defended at the pre-university in 1973. I happened to be there at the time on my sabbatical, and so I had the privilege of participating in his defense of his dissertation. It was called 2 Decades of Reformed Thought and Life in America. He took basically the period from 1890 to 1910. I'm sorry, from 1890 to the close of World War I, 1918. And he went through all of the journals and all of the newspapers and the writings of that period. And he came to the conclusion that around the turn of the century, there were basically 3 parties in the Christian Reformed community. The one party he called the Confessional Reformed. Their major concern was to maintain Reformed doctrinal orthodoxy. They were basically the A's. There was a second group whom he called, let's say, the Kuyperian Calvinists. Their concern was this broader witness and broader influence and testimony in the midst of the world. Well, that was the B. But he said there's a third group whom he called the American Calvinists. They were Calvinists, but they said we're in America now. And this A and B business, that's all Dutch. We got to leave that behind, you know. That's okay, okay in the old country. But now we're in America. We got to learn the English language. We got to learn the English ways. We got to run our churches like American churches. We got to start being friendly like American churches are friendly. And we got to do things the way America. We want to be reformed. But their big emphasis was we got to become Americanized. We must become Americanized. And to them, that meant that these battles belong to our past, and we ought to forget about that and move ahead and become good all around American Calvin citizens. And Swanska's argument is that by 1918, it was this third party which had emerged triumphant. Okay. Now, I think you can draw some conclusions from that. The evidences are there. In that year, 1918, the churches had to face their first real challenge from American theology. The case of Maranatha, Reverend Harry Bultima from Muskegon, Michigan, with his views, which are very much like Hal Lindsey's views today, dispensational views, and millennium, 1,000 years and all that. The kind of stuff that we hear regularly in WFUR in Grand Rapids. And don't think that that doesn't influence people when they listen to that day after day after day after day. No preacher, no matter how good he is on Sunday, can counteract 6 days of that. And Well, they faced that, and that was their first real challenge, theological challenge, that came from the American world. And it meant a bit of a break. Then in 1922, we had our Professor Jansen case. Professor Jansen was the only seminary teacher who taught in English, because he was American trained. And they saw in his teaching the influence of American theological ideas, critical of the Bible and a lot of other things. And so we had our Jansen case, as they said, and he was removed from his office. Then in 1924, we had the Common Grace. And Hoeksema and Danhoff said, really, what all the Christian Reformed Church is doing is covering up its worldliness by appealing to common grace. They said, oh, there's so many good things in the American world. God sheds his common grace abroad in the American world too, doesn't he? And so we were justifying becoming Americanized and becoming worldly like the American world was worldly by appealing to common grace. So a lot of these things were happening in that period of time as a result of what Zwanster says was the triumph of the American Calvinist wing within the CRC. And I think that explains the fact, too, that from 1925, say, till 1950, the thing that I referred to a while ago, every attempt at a Christian political movement, a Christian labor movement, Christian journalism, they all went down one after another because they were considered to be anti-American. Those are Dutch ways of doing politics. You have separate parties in the Netherlands, but we Americans don't have separate political parties. And so one after another, due to this kind of Americanizing influence, much of what the A and especially the B stood for got submerged. Nobody could write a book on Dutch roots at that time because they were all trying to forget their Dutch roots and their Dutch heritage. We were taught we should become all American boys and we can become president someday. Because we've all been thrust, thank God, into the melting pot. It's only in the last decade or two that people have been questioning the melting pot, you know, and say, what's wrong with being Dutch or Polish or Irish or something else? Well, that's one analysis, plus one. Then in 1973, Reverend Clarence Boomsma, Calvin Church, Grand Rapids, ran a long series of articles in the Banner, you may recall them, entitled, What's Happening to Us? We've lost our homogeneity. You know, we used to be a one church. No matter which CRC church you went into, north, south, east, or west, you didn't need a bulletin because the liturgy was always the same. Order of worship, you, as a guest preacher, you just walk in, you knew what came after what, you know. Today, if you don't have a liturgy 2 days in advance, the guest preacher messes everything up. And that's only a symptom of something bigger and deeper, that we aren't homogeneous the way we used to be. Okay, that was Boomsma's question, you know, why have we lost our homogeneity? What's happening to us anyway? And he said, there's four parties. Now there are four parties. The one are called the militant orthodox. I think that's the contemporary A group coming back. Now he identified them with the ACRL and Outlook magazine. Militant orthodoxy. They want to maintain the doctrinal orthodoxy of the church, and they're very, very militant about it. And these are the examples. Another group he called the liberalizers. Now, don't say liberals. Liberalizers. I think that's the American Calvinist group that Zwanster talked about as being triumphant. And Boomsma said, you find those mostly in Reformed Germany. They want to be open to the American world. Then you have, the neo-type period. Because there have been some advances. You don't say the same things the same way Kuyper said them, but generally in his tradition. The neo-Kuyperian movement, with its world and life view. And you find that basically in the AA, CS, and the ICF, the Institute for Christian Studies in Toronto.
Whenever people say Toronto, that means Neo-Kuyperian.
Now, all of these have been there earlier. The A's, the B's, and the American Celts. But now, we got a fourth group that's never been there before. The Charismatics.
The Neo-Pentecostals. Writing in 1973, that's new on the scene within our circles. Only in the late 60s and early 70s, for the first time, have we really encountered that expression of Christianity in our circles.
Well, basically, you have the A and the B keep coming back. Well, finally, in 1975, that would be 3 years ago, Nick Waldersdorf gave a lecture in Grand Rapids, and it took so well, they asked him to repeat it to Chicago, and then again in Hamilton, Ontario, and finally got printed in the Banner, and I think in the Reformed Journal, too, in which he analyzed the AACS, what's it all about. He said, to understand the AACS, you've got to understand 100 years of our history. You've got to understand about A, you've got to understand B. And he came to the conclusion that in the 100-year history of our church, there are basically three parties. He called them. He didn't call them. But a reporter was there for one of his speeches and reported it as only a journalist can. There are the docks, the pines, and the kites.
The docks, the pies, and the kites. The docks are the doctrinalists. Those who say, the most important thing in being a Christian is keeping your doctrine straight.
And the pietists says, no, the most important thing about being a Christian is pious practice. Don't smoke, don't chew, and a lot of other practices. Don't go with the girls that do. That's what they used to sing. When I was in high school, I played some of the basketball games at some of the outlying public high schools. Once in a while, that would come across from the other side. No, we don't smoke, and we don't chew, and we don't go with the girls that do. Our class won the Bible. Now, were we giving them the impression that being Christians and involved in Christian education was that we were more pious than the others? Or were they just taunting us? Was it the kind of persecution we should, endure for righteousness' sake? But the pietist says that being a good Christian is observing good moral conduct and practice. They're not so concerned about whether you understand what justification, double predestination, and all this is about, like the doctrine. In fact, they say, that's really pretty dangerous to bother your head too much about that. It's more important to listen to good, spine tingling sermons and forget the doctrine. Because the important thing is your daily practice, that you're pious. And then the kites, they keep coming back and say, it's bigger than all of that. Christ is Lord of lords and King of kings. All authority is mine in heaven and on earth. I claim the whole wide world is mine. You're my disciples, and you've got to go into that world and be my witnesses. Okay. And I think Waldersdorf is right, except that these are really both A and this is B, and so we're right back to A and B. Because I think doctrinalism and pietism are really two sides of the same reality. And if you go through the Viralti sermons, the first part is doctrine, and then you get the tupasi, and that's the pietism. So I think the docs and the pies are really two sides of the A movement, and then you got the B, and so that's our whole history again. And we still got it with us. And that's what makes us what we are. For better, for worse. Okay. Let's talk about it a little bit. Who wants to be the first?
Yes.
Okay, ladies before gentlemen. Next, back to you, Bill.
Thanks a lot.
10 years ago at one of our Calvin alumni meetings, Griffin Frame spoke on the A and the B. And he said then, and I wonder what your reaction would be to it, he said that in God's providence, it was necessary for the A's to remain aloof as long as it did, because it solidified. And that way the bees would be stronger, because God allowed them to have the time to gel. How do you feel about that?
I think John Cumming, in his book on the history of the Christian Reformed Church, develops that thesis, that they were such a small, struggling band in the vast American wilderness that it was a matter of survival for them not to become involved in the world, because had they become involved, they probably would have gotten swallowed up in it. Okay. So it's probably, you know, a mixed blessing. And certainly, you know, the Bible never gives us an excuse for saying that the heart of the Christian life is taking your talent, putting it in a napkin, and burying it in the ground. But maybe the situation sometimes is so tough that for a while you have to go into hiding, so that later on, when you're stronger and ready to stand up to it, that you can, you know.
I thought that was a charitable attitude, because so often they're criticized, the AIDS, they're criticized completely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bill.
As an innocent bystander, way back in the days when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, Sunday night in our house and in the homes of many of our friends and relatives meant hellfire and brimstone session on doctrine, to the point that I used to feel sorry for the preacher, because they were fist slamming and really trying to drive a point. And way back then, I detected a positive difference of direction with a number of people. I'm wondering whether you as a minister or you as an educator have been able to detect these strong A's and strong B's coming out of your students, even this far removed from the early 1900s or the 1800s.
Yeah. Whenever I take time to go through Niebuhr's book, for example, Isolation, Accommodation, I ask them to think about their own home, their own schools, their own churches, their own communities. What kinds of formative influences have gone into their lives for the first 20 years or so? And many of them that are free enough to open up will say, well, Nick Waldersdorf in that article says, my mother was a pietist. My father was a Kuyperian. My grandmother, and he identified them, he could see them back in his own family tree, you know, that... Not that anyone is cleanly this or cleanly that, but more this than prevailingly one or the other. Yeah, sure. And I think that's part of reflecting upon our way, you know, the way that the Lord has led us to find out. You know, that's why one must always be thankful to his spiritual mother, even the CRC. And yet, as you grow older, you begin to recognize some of the weaknesses of your spiritual mother. The fact that, really, I went through almost the first quarter century of my life before anybody ever talked to me about this. You know, I can't recall even a 15-minute session anywhere in the first 25 years of my life that really opened that up. Yeah.
What impact does American fundamentalism have?
I think that this is far more wide open to fundamentalist influence than this is. And so we've always had a kind of an openness toward fundamentalism because of this A streak in us. And then given the fact that here we were as a Reformed community, along with the RCA and a few others, but a minority Reformed community in an American world which was dominated on the left by liberalism and on the right by fundamentalism. And if we wanted company anywhere, we knew it couldn't be these people. So whenever we wanted to keep company with American Christians, it tended to be with these kind. And then, of course, that begins to show up too. Now, I don't want to step unnecessarily on any toes here, because I don't know what goes on upstairs here. But I'm concerned with the hymn books that I find in the pews when I go around preaching. I would guess of the
25 different churches that I've preached in over the past, let's say, couple of years. I would guess more than 20 have introduced hymn books alongside of the Psalter hymnal. And first, of course, they're sung in 10-minute song service before, but pretty soon they get smuggled in. And then people get to love them more than they do the Psalter hymnal, because these are the hymns they hear all week at WNBI and WFUR and other radio stations. And when they go on summer vacations to Maranatha and Gun Lake, this is what they sing. And they come back and they say, oh, those psalms are so bad. And this is what they want to sing, you know. And I think that's just another little fox at work in the grapevine. They say the Reformation, for many people, the Reformation sang its way into people's hearts. It can sing its way out too. You get the wrong kinds of songs. Now, I'm not pleading for dead songs. If the psalms aren't lively enough, okay, we can do something about that. But, you know, the thinking, the ideas that come along with many of these current American gospel tunes just won't stand the test of the scripture and our confessions. This weekend I have to be in Alberta, and on the way back at a conference at Dort, a Reformation conference, and they asked me to give a lecture there. And so on the spot I gave them a title. I said, Reformation and Fundamentalism. And the subtitle is, Who's Covering the Right Front? The Right Flank, you know. The left flank, that's the liberals. We're always covering the left flank. But who's covering the right flank? I'm not saying these evangelical are not my brethren in Jesus Christ. That's not the point. They are Bible-believing Christians, and I shake their hand as a brother in Jesus Christ. But that doesn't mean that there aren't differences that are important. Mr. Voss, Herr Voss, from all the way back.
Those are the signs that some people around circles are trying to counteract this movement of using the rock and roll band music in our church services for special moves, with guitars, that thing like that.
Well, I don't, you know, everybody's free to talk here. This is wide open. There are no ground rules. I don't mind a guitar in church either. If the song is the right song, if it's a song of praise to the Lord and so on, I don't mind a guitar. I don't want to think we ought to canonize the organ and say the organ is the only way to worship. But let's be mindful of what we're singing as we sing.
Well, I'd refer particularly to the magnified sound.
So. Oh, yeah, I can't stand that either when the devil. Now, I think there are some styles of music, and you know worlds more about that than I do. There are some styles of music that are, I feel, are inappropriate to worship. Gene.
I think that Dr. Pick at one time, I think this was about 5 years ago, mentioned that in his studies of Western Michigan and people's problems that were phoned in and discussions that he had with people, that there really continually showed up a dispirited, down, depressed Christian community in which it was sin burdened and sin laden. And I don't know what studies have been made since then. Do you think that is still the case?
Boy, we're going to have to watch our time, because these questions are good for 10 minutes, peace at least. I have a feeling, now that's more than a feeling, it's getting to be a little bit of a conviction, that we don't experience the joys of salvation because we've never really gone to the depths of our own sin and guilt. You know, when the sense of sin and guilt gets flattened out, then the rest gets flattened out too. And all of this talk about I'm okay, you're okay, and that we ought to get rid of a sense of guilt, I think that we need a deep and profound sense of guilt for our sins and shortcomings. And only when you've been deep down into that dark valley can you really rise to the mountaintop. But then you can. You know. And once you've gone through it, then there's no need for this kind of depression. You're always carrying that burden, you know. Jesus came to die for sins, but didn't die for me. There was the professor, Minister Colebrook in the Netherlands. He would preach Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. He was a Bible-believing preacher. And the mayor of the town was a member of his church. And he would listen to the sermon. He was a God-fearing man.